Well, good afternoon. This is the Dogs Program,
the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools.
And we're here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education. That means that we are very unhappy with the enormous amount of public money in both direct and indirect grants that are going to the richest private schools. We are producing a very unequal society through our education system at the moment. Trevor Coble from Save Our Schools has been looking at the facts and figures. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. 50 richest Victorian private schools rake in nearly $150 million in non-fee income. And this is an article by Trevor Cobbold, published on June the 23rd. New figures obtained from the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, the ACNC, show that 50 private schools serving the richest families in Victoria raked in nearly $150 million in 2023 from donations, investment income, and other income. Shockingly, this money is ignored by government when determining taxpayer funding of these schools. It is a fundamental flaw in how the Commonwealth Government funds rich, exclusive private schools. It means they are being overfunded compared to public and other private schools that do not have such privileged income streams. It is an inequity that must be ended. Financial statements and reports lodged with the Charities Commission show that 50 schools with a median adjusted taxable family income of over $200,000 a year received $148.8 million in 2023 from donations, investment income and other income, such as from rental properties, hire of facilities and sale of assets, up by $19 million over the previous year. They received $43.8 million in donations, $27.9 million as investment income, and $77.8 million in other income. Of the 50 schools, 22 received $120.2 million from these sources. 11 received $84.5 million. The 50 schools got $416 million in government funding in 2023. The big winners are Brighton Grammar and Melbourne Grammar. Brighton Grammar raked in $9.9 million, including $4.5 million in donations, $1.5 million from investments, and $3.8 million in other income. According to school family income data released to Senate estimates by the Department of Education, the median family income for Brighton Grammar was $302,000, and 25% of its families had an income of more than $494,000. Despite its privileged families and other income sources, the MySchool website shows it received $7.1 million in government funding in 2023, with $5.6 million coming from the Commonwealth and $1.5 million from the Victorian government. Melbourne Grammar collected $9.8 million, including $5.9 million in donations, $1.5 million in investment income, and $2.3 million in other income. Its median family income was $336,000 a year, and 25% of families had an income of over $616,000. It received $8.4 million in government funding in 2023, with $6.6 million from the Commonwealth and $1.7 million from the Victorian government. Carey Grammar received $8.5 million in non-fee income, including $0.6 million in donations, $1.6 million in investment income, and $6.3 million in other income. Its median family income was $300,000 a year, and 25% had an income of over $532,000. It received $11.5 million in government funding in 2023, with $9 million from the Commonwealth and $2.5 million from the Victorian government. Caulfield Grammar collected $8.4 million, including $2 million in donations, $0.6 million from investments, and $5.8 million from other sources. Its median family income was $257,000 a year, and 25% had an income of over $425,000. It received $13.2 million in government funding in 2023, with $9.4 million from the Commonwealth and $3.8 million from the Victorian government. Seven other schools collected over $5 million from such sources. They are Scotch College, $7.9 million, Methodist Ladies College, $7.2 million, Xavier College, $6.8 million, Geelong College, $6.7 million, Ivanhoe Grammar, $6.7 million, Geelong Grammar, $6.4 million, and Bialik College, $6.1 million. Mount Scopus Memorial College had the highest median family income of all these privileged schools at $344,000 a year, and 25% of families had an income of over $565,000. The school collected a non-fee income of $3.6 million in 2023, including $1.8 million in donations, $0.4 million from its financial investments, and $1.3 million in other income. It received $7.2 million in government funding as well, $5.6 million from the Commonwealth, and $1.6 million from the Victorian government. It really is a case of welfare for the rich. In this context, it is worth noting that the family income measure is adjusted taxable income, which is generally far less than the total income of the wealthy because they can take advantage of an array of tax concessions such as negative gearing, capital gains discount, deductible donations, and gifts to reduce their taxable income. For example, Australian Taxation Office statistics show that 188 millionaires had a taxable income of $18,200 or less in 2021-22 and therefore paid no income tax. The donation stream for these schools is supported by multiple tax-exempt organisations such as foundations, building funds, scholarship funds, library and funds or trusts which have deductible gift recipient DGR status. Donations to these funds are tax deductible for the donors. This is effectively another form of taxpayer subsidy for the schools, as they would receive fewer donations without the DGR status. For example, Melbourne Grammar has a foundation, building, scholarship and library funds and an arts trust according to the DGR register. Brighton Grammar has a foundation and building fund. Caulfield Grammar has a foundation, a building fund and a scholarship fund. Scotch College has numerous trusts and beneficial funds that provide funding for the school. Indeed, it has so many that it had a special act of the Victorian Parliament passed in 2001 to enable it to pool the investment of those trust funds in one or more common funds to minimise administrative costs of operating each fund and increase its investment income. Scotch College has its own building, library and museum funds. The Scotch College Foundation raises money for the school through numerous funds, including scholarships, bursaries, arts, library and endowment funds. The foundation had assets of $119 million in 2024, according to its annual information statement to the ACNC. School building and other DGR funds are largely the preserve of rich schools. A report by the Productivity Commission on Philanthropy showed that such funds are heavily concentrated in highly privileged schools. For example, seven schools out of 719 schools, or 1% of schools with tax-deductible school building funds, received $24.6 million in donations in 2020 to 2021, which is 35% of all donations to building funds. Just 72 schools, 10% of schools with such funds, received $58 million, representing 84% of all donations to building funds. In regard to schools with multiple funds, 74 schools out of 736, about 10%, with such funds received $133 million in tax-deductible donations, which is 71% of all donations to such funds. The Commission recommends removing tax deductibility for these funds. Many rich, exclusive Victorian private schools also receive donations from the Australian Universities and Schools USA Foundation, which is incorporated in the United States. Melbourne Grammar, Scotch College, Geelong Grammar and Xavier College are members of the foundation. It raised about $13 million over 2019 to 2023 for its affiliates. Apart from receiving millions in donations and dividends from financial investments, many schools obtain substantial income from rental properties and hiring out facilities such as swimming pools and theatres. For example, PLC received $1 million from the hire of its aquatic centre in 2023, while Hunting Tower got $1.1 million from its aquatic centre and Melbourne Grammar got just under $0.9 million. Hunting Tower received $4.9 million over 2018 to 2023, and PLC $4.6 million. Caulfield Grammar received $0.8 million from the operation of a dairy farm it uses as an outdoor education centre. During 2018 to 2023, it received $4.5 million from this source. It also received $800,000 in rental income and a total of $4.2 million from this source over 2018 to 2023. None of this commercial income is subject to income tax because private schools are classified as charities and therefore are tax exempt. A charity can undertake commercial activities with the purpose of generating profit to fund its charitable purpose or where the activity is only incidental to the purpose of the charity. It is incredible that tax exempt commercially derived income of private schools is ignored in how taxpayer funding of private schools is determined. Rich private schools attract millions in tax-deductible donations to build luxurious facilities, which they are able to hire out to earn income that is also disregarded in assessing their government funding entitlement. Only the rich benefit from this arrangement. Commonwealth government funding of private schools ignores all this non-fee income. It is based only on the capacity of families to pay fees, called the Capacity to Contribute, CTC, which is measured by the adjusted taxable income of families as reported by the Australian Taxation Office. Disregard of donations, investment income, and other commercially sourced income is a major loophole in the private school funding system. It provides enormous benefits to rich families and wealthy schools who are best placed to take advantage of the loophole. The benefits are not available to any significant extent to public schools and less advantaged private schools. In summary, the loophole results in higher government funding for schools than if non-fee income were included in the Commonwealth Government funding assessment. Moreover, government funding of these schools is boosted by the ability of rich families to take advantage of the tax-deductible status of building and other funds to reduce their taxable income. Such claims reduce the median adjusted taxable family income used to determine government funding. Schools also have incentives to maximise their income from financial investments, rental properties and hire facilities because this income is tax exempt. Wealthy schools are in the privileged position of being able to collect millions in donations to fund more luxurious facilities which they can hire out to gain tax-exempt income. All this is because, by some twisted logic, these schools are regarded as charities. These arrangements result in massive overfunding of wealthy private schools by the taxpayer. It is a huge waste of funds and simply adds to the huge resource advantage that exclusive private schools have over public schools. It reduces the amount of funds that would have far greater impact if spent on schools educating children from disadvantaged backgrounds. One step towards a fairer funding method and eliminating the waste is to include non-fee income of private schools, especially that flowing to the richest schools, in determining their level of Commonwealth government funding. The Albanese government should commission the National School Resourcing Board to conduct an inquiry on including non-fee income in the funding model to ensure fairer funding of private schools. A further step would be to adopt the recommendation of the Productivity Commission that school building funds no longer be eligible for tax-deductible donations. And back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy. And this is a situation which is being exacerbated by a Labor Party in the federal sphere, but in the Victorian sphere. And there is fury over the Allan government's public school funding cuts. Once again, Andy will tell us about it.
Thanks, Jean. Fury over Allan government's public school funding cuts. Hundreds of Victorian principals, education support staff and teachers will rally outside the office of Education Minister Ben Carroll to express their anger at the Allan Labor government's funding cuts to public schools. School staff anger is palpable, with recent revelations in Parliament that Victorian public school students are being cheated of $663 million in funding every year that the Allan Labor government doesn't deliver. The Allan government have decided to deny public schools billions of dollars by delaying their commitment to fully fund public schools to 2031. Australian Education Union Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly said that school staff are furious at the duplicity of the Allan Labor government and their funding con job. AEU members are rallying today to demand the Education Minister fixes his government's mess and acts to ensure every Victorian public school is fully funded. And we will keep campaigning and rallying until the funding cuts are resolved, Mr. Mullaly said. Right now, Victoria's public schools are the lowest funded in the country and our teachers are the lowest paid, with education support staff and school leaders undervalued. To deny this funding during a chronic shortage of teachers shows how out of touch the Labor government is. Valuing and respecting school staff through fair and decent pay is a key way to retain existing employees and attract the next generation to our profession. The idea that Victoria is the education state is simply nonsense when the Allan Labor government are cutting and running from public education funding. Premier Jacinta Allan and Education Minister Ben Carroll need to explain why they do not value Victorian public school students and their teachers, principals and education support staff. Schools in New South Wales and other states and territories are already funded to the level which is being denied to Victorian public schools because of funding cuts by the Premier and her government. The Allan Labor government must deliver full funding in a fair and meaningful way. This will ensure Victorian public school principals can attract and retain teachers and education support staff, reduce class sizes, and provide more of the individual support every student needs. And back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, that's the main news for the day. So we'll have a break from it, shall we, and come back for some more interesting news.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station.
Call 03 9419 8377 or sign up online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
We hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program and that we've persuaded you that we need to defend and to promote our public schools. And here is Sorrel with a very interesting article written by Parsi Salberg. Over to you, Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article was written by Parsi Salberg and Glenn Savage and is entitled The Next Three Steps to Help Public Schools. Australia has the resources, the talent, and now a government with enough political capital to build better and fairer education systems, if we're brave enough to act. With its landslide victory, the second Albanese government has the power to honour the vision set out in the 2019 Alice Springs Mbantwa Education Declaration, that all schools should be both excellent and equitable. If you followed Australian education debates in recent years, you may have concluded that the only problem facing schools is a lack of funding, or that all our students are falling behind their international peers, all teachers are failing to teach well, and our education systems are in terminal decline. None of this is true. We have world-class education, but not for all. This isn't a simple story of elite private schools or selective public schools outperforming the rest. High-performing schools exist in every state, territory, and sector, but these are isolated pockets of excellence. We have never figured out how to learn from these schools and spread their success across the nation. It takes much more than money to lift results. In Finland, for example, educational success is built on the belief that every child, regardless of background, can thrive if learning is personalised and well-being prioritised. Australian school education too often narrows its focus to test scores and rankings. Real improvement demands a broader vision, one that values teacher expertise, supports student engagement, and puts equity at the centre of the system. Education is deeply valued by the Australian public. By international standards, we spend a significant amount on it. 4% of GDP, roughly 20% above the OECD average. But one in every five of these dollars comes directly from families, compared with just one in 10 in the OECD countries on average. This includes voluntary contributions that many parents feel obligated to make, even at public schools, adding to the pressure on household budgets. The perennial problem for Australia is that resources to fund schools are not allocated fairly. Since the 2011 Gonski Review, governments have repeatedly promised to fully fund public schools according to the Schooling Resource Standard, or SRS, a model designed to ensure that every school has the resources it needs based on its student population. Yet, last year, public schools were funded at just 87.6% of their SRS target, despite educating 4 out of 5 disadvantaged students in the country. Australia's big problem is a lack of bold thinking about what schools can be. The federal government must act not only as a funder or builder, but also as a convener of vision, aligning efforts across systems, increasing social equity, and reigniting public purpose in education. Just before the 2025 election was called, all states and territories signed new funding agreements with the federal government under the Better and Fairer Schools Agreement, the BFSA. These commit the Commonwealth to increase its share of public funding from 20 to 25%, with states and territories contributing the rest and a full transition expected by 2034. Crucially, the deal also closed a loophole that allowed governments to count up to 4% of non-school spending as part of their contribution. That provision will be phased out, with tighter rules on eligible expenditures. In total, the BFSA is projected to deliver an additional $16.5 billion in Commonwealth funding to public schools over the next decade. With all jurisdictions now on a path to full funding, the national conversation must shift to how the extra money is used to ensure that financial investments lead to better and fairer education systems for all. This challenge has 2 inseparable parts: improving student learning outcomes and life chances, and tackling social and economic inequities by narrowing the persistent achievement gaps between advantaged and disadvantaged students. Here are 3 practical steps the new government should consider. First, the federal government should work with jurisdictions and school sectors to prioritise immediate and full funding for public schools with the highest levels of socio-educational disadvantage. Under the BFSA, the path to full funding stretches out to nearly a decade away. Schools serving the most disadvantaged communities cannot be expected to deliver on national goals while starting with such a handicap. Nearly 30% of Australia's 6,700 public schools serve communities where more than half of students face significant barriers to learning, from poverty and household insecurity to disability and trauma. These schools must be placed at the front of the funding queue. With fair and adequate resourcing, including access to qualified teachers, support staff, and healthy meals, these schools will be far better positioned to support their students and close long-standing achievement gaps. A fresh look at the timelines, clearer implementation expectations, and targeted support for the most disadvantaged students would send a powerful signal. Equity is not just a motherhood statement, but also an urgent priority. Our most disadvantaged schools cannot afford to wait. Second, invest in collaboration between schools, building networks and fostering a culture of professional trust. We must think differently about how we use evidence in schooling policy and reform. For too long, Australian education has been shaped by a narrow, top-down and federally driven approach, often resulting in generic solutions that ignore the diversity of local contexts across the country. Any experienced educator knows that genuine improvement comes from within schools, not from above them. It emerges from deep professional knowledge, sustained inquiry, and the ability to adapt and respond to local needs. The federal government should reposition itself not as the controller of evidence, but rather as a steward of collaboration and innovation. Even well-intentioned reforms flagged in the BFSA, such as universal phonics checks and small group tutoring, rest on the assumption that whatever works in one school should work everywhere. The Albanese government can help shift the national narrative on evidence from standardised solutions to ones rooted in teachers' professional judgment and local learning. That shift could empower schools not only to implement change, but to lead it. Third, we must address the underlying causes of educational decline, not just its symptoms. Too often, Australian education is framed in terms of a crisis, of falling NAPLAN or PISA scores. These figures tell only part of the story and reflect the symptoms of root problems. As in medicine, the real diagnosis lies deeper. Beneath the surface is a quiet but urgent challenge: growing student disengagement and increasing teacher burnout. Since 2003, 15-year-olds' sense of belonging at school has declined by more than twice the OECD average. In Victoria, for example, only half of secondary students say their school provides a stimulating learning environment. These aren't just unfortunate statistics. They show that our schools are struggling to connect with young people. If students no longer feel valued or inspired, that is a crisis, and one that demands more than test-driven policy responses. More funding may help, but it is not a panacea. Helping students to catch up and finish school is necessary but not sufficient. If children disengage from school, teachers will follow and vice versa. Indeed, recent surveys suggest nearly half of Australian teachers and principals are considering leaving the profession. Real reform must make schools places of genuine belonging, curiosity, and professional purpose. Ultimately, the challenge is to ensure school is a place where all students are engaged and curious to learn, and where teachers are trusted and inspired to teach. As the Albanese government takes the reins for its second term, it should use its renewed political capital and fiscal levers not simply to fill funding gaps, but also to drive a more ambitious national education agenda, guided by these three steps. Education Minister Jason Clare is right to say the Commonwealth investment should come with clear expectations, but these must go beyond compliance. They should reflect a shared national commitment to making Australian schools world leading. Australia's big problem is a lack of bold thinking about what schools can be. The federal government must not only act as a funder or builder, but also as a convener of vision, aligning efforts across systems, increasing social equity, and reigniting public purpose in education. This kind of big picture thinking has disappeared. Ministerial meetings shouldn't simply be venues for transactional negotiation, but instead spaces for bold ideas and dialogue. International evidence shows there is more than one path to a successful school system, yet many Australian school systems expect students with vastly different needs should be taught and assessed in largely uniform ways. Top education systems take a different approach. They empower teachers to tailor their practice and collaborate on school improvement, showing that better outcomes come from responsiveness and trust, not from compliance and uniformity. In recent years, Australia has stood back from global dialogue, as others have pushed ahead. In 2027, however, Australia may be offered an opportunity to host the 17th International Summit on the Teaching Profession, a high-level gathering of the world's top education systems, convened by the OECD and Education International. It's the perfect opportunity to show that Australia is ready to listen and ready to lead in shaping the future of schooling. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Sorrel. And we must remind you that the vast majority of Australian children go to our public schools, and they do a wonderful job. Our teachers do a wonderful job in teaching our children to think for themselves. And the next article was written by a student from, I think it was Newcastle High, and it's rather a fun one. Let's hear from Andy on diplomatic insolence.
Thanks, Jean. Diplomatic insolence. And this is written by Morgan Campbell, and it was published in the March edition of The Monthly. In 2007, the Year 10 students at my school in Newcastle were invited to apply for two spots as delegates to a University of Sydney Model United Nations Day. Even at a selective school full of bumptious twerps, I was bumptious enough to see this as an exciting opportunity and to get selected for our team. Our first task, well in advance of the day, was to select our preferences for which countries we wanted to represent in a mock Security Council. My teammate, whom we'll call Henry, emitted a powerful aura of future leader. It was his destiny to become school captain, steamroll the HSC, cite leadership qualities on his CV, and make a fortune somewhere. I deactivated my LinkedIn a few years ago after a friend and I stopped using it to add as many fringe first grade rugby league players of the 90s and early 2000s as we could, so I don't know what Henry actually went on to do, but I can imagine, and good luck to him. His first choice was France. It was a solid, serious choice, bearing the sheen of history and prestige and permanent member status. My own aura was more future vexatious litigant, and so I chose Iran. I didn't know a lot about Iran. Most of my exposure to Persian culture had come through ads for Romani's Rug Gallery, which seemed to be perpetually closing down. I didn't know, for example, that Iran hasn't actually been a member of the UN Security Council since 1956. I hadn't taken the time to discover that in 2006, the Iranian government had introduced a quota system to limit the number of women attending university. I didn't know that a few months after my turn in his fictional diplomatic service, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad would say that there were no homosexuals in Iran, or that he had repeatedly called the Holocaust a myth. It didn't occur to me that in Iran, you would only have to be half as lippy as me in criticising any of these things to end up in prison for a long time. What I did know, thanks mostly to the books and films of Michael Moore, was that the United States was wrong most of the time. I was clear that it had disgraced itself in the Middle East and that America was a shambles of bigotry and guns and inequality. This was enough for me. The late W. Bush era offered a bounty of contradictions for the eager young blusterer to point to and say, "What about that?" With an approach no more detailed or nuanced than asking, "Who are they to say who gets to have nuclear weapons?" and "What happened to Saddam's WMDs?" I was ready to do my inflammatory, anti-authority, but not anti-authoritarian duty. I agreed with Henry that we would put France as our first choice, as long as we could put Iran as our second. Shockingly, it seems France had been quite a popular selection, and Iran less so, because about a fortnight before the event, we were informed that we would be getting our second choice. I was energised, and after some time reviewing the rules and procedures and the notes of the organisers sent us about topics to be discussed, I was ready. On the day, as I loitered outside the Sydney campus, I met a fellow delegate who, recognising another high school uniform, had come over to make common cause in finding the meeting point. "Which school are you from?" I asked him. "Cranbrook," he replied. I knew that was a private school, but I was still a few minutes away from finding out that all the biggies were there, and that me and Henry were in fact the only public school team in our session. I have no idea why this was. Maybe sociologists were watching us through a two-way mirror. Merriweather was a good school, a selective school that I was lucky to go to, but it wasn't hugely exceptional, as selective schools go. Had a public school been deliberately selected to take on the Blazers, we would not have been the obvious challenger. It didn't really change anything, though. I had approached the day as a chance to have a few squabbles and be contrary, and that was still the plan. I don't remember whether people had started saying network as a professional verb by 2007, but I wasn't interested in doing it. My priorities shifted somewhat when two girls in blazers spotted the flags on our name tags, came over and introduced themselves and said that they were the Russian delegation and that they would be supporting us when we got in there. For the bookish 15-year-old, it was the stuff of fable. The equivalent of, "I've got two tickets to Iron Maiden, baby. Come with me Friday, don't say maybe." They were from Darlinghurst's Sydney Church of England Girls Grammar School, where the tuition fee for Year 10 this year will be $46,004. My family once had our phone cut off because we couldn't pay the bill, and this, combined with the fact that getting to the event had taken me 45 minutes in the car with my mother, then 2 hours on the 6 a.m. train, then a trip on the bus, gave me a claim to being both literally and figuratively from the wrong side of the tracks. I hadn't heard Common People by Pulp at that stage of my life, and that was for the best. When we got into the little seminar room and started the proceedings, it was all fairly gentle. The teams, who were sat at school desks arranged in a U-shape, introduced themselves and outlined their positions on the main issues, and the debate started on the first draft resolution, everyone having a nice time and looking amused by the role play. I had a quiet look at things for half an hour or so, then cut loose. The first time I interrupted and called a point of order, citing the specific dot point, the room fell silent. 30 or so sets of confused eyes settled on me, then turned to the convener, a kindly and earnest young academic, who confirmed that I had acted within the rules. It was just the encouragement I needed. And from there, I interjected, hectored, moved amendments, sought leave of the council to make a 5-minute statement, and passed notes to the Russians, who used their veto power to snuff out anything approaching a consensus on nuclear non-proliferation. I was magnificent. We won best delegation. As a child from a rugby league town in the Hunter Valley that even the other Merriweather kids made fun of, this day confirmed every one of my class prejudices. Here was the decadence and dilettantism of the silver spooned elite, in every slipshod argument and procedural faux pas. I was operating with a hunger and energy they simply couldn't match. They had brought knives to a gunfight, Velcro tags to the state of origin. Their excuse for a day off school was my realization of destiny, a victory of tenacity over privilege, a demonstration of the political force of the mobilized prole. I was Keating against Hewson, Warne against England. At the end, when all the Model UNs that had been scattered across the campus reassembled in a big hall for that presentation, I was appointed to report back on our day's work. I said that while we'd had a very interesting debate, our inability to settle any of the resolutions meant that it was ultimately pointless. Having got the fizz of scandalised laughter I'd been looking for, I sat down and the convener returned to the mic to tell us that we shouldn't see it like that, that the day had been about learning and exchanging ideas. But I was right, in my own case at least. Fighting the good fight for a repressive pariah state, weightless in righteous abstraction, I hadn't learnt anything. Now back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And you can see how thoughtful and obviously good thinking people our students are that are coming out of our public schools there. And we need them, don't we? We need them in this time of very strange media misinformation. But we'll have a bit of a break. And we'll come back for some international news.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR. Well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program. We have to apologise for Jeff tonight. Jeff has a very bad cold and he doesn't want you to listen to his cough on the radio. But Dale is going to stand in for him with some news from the United States. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is from Diane Ravitch's blog, The Battle Over the Ten Commandments in the Classroom. On Friday, the 20th of June, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Louisiana's law requiring that schools post the Ten Commandments in every classroom. On Saturday, June 21st, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas announced that he had signed a law requiring that the Ten Commandments be posted in every classroom in that state. The goal of plastering the Ten Commandments in every schoolroom is promoted by Christian nationalists who want to see an official declaration that the U.S. is a Christian nation. The Founding Fathers would be stunned to hear the assertion that the Constitution they wrote was influenced by the Ten Commandments. The First Amendment very clearly states the importance of freedom of religion, meaning that anyone could practice any religion or none at all. It also declares that government should not establish any religion, meaning that government should not sponsor or endorse or favor any religion. CNN reported, Texas law requires public schools to post in classrooms a 16 by 20 inch poster or framed copy of a specific English version of the commandments, even though translations and interpretations vary across denominations, faiths, and languages, and may differ in homes and houses of worship. Supporters say the Ten Commandments are part of the foundation of the United States judicial and educational systems and should be displayed. NPR reported on the decision striking down the Louisiana law. Its supporters said that the Ten Commandments were the foundation of the American legal system. The state of Louisiana intends to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court's ruling stems from a lawsuit last year by parents of Louisiana school children from various religious backgrounds who said the law violates First Amendment language guaranteeing religious liberty and forbidding government establishment of religion. The ruling also backs an order issued last autumn by U.S. District Judge John DeGravel, who declared the mandate unconstitutional and ordered state education officials not to enforce it and to notify all local school boards in the state of his decision. Republican Governor Jeff Landry signed the mandate into law last June. Landry said in a statement Friday that he supports the Attorney General's plans to appeal. The Ten Commandments are the foundation of our laws, serving both an educational and historical purpose in our classrooms, Landry said. The Founding Fathers would laugh at Governor Abbott and Landry and Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who shepherded in a similar law in Arkansas. It's especially funny that the leader of their party has broken almost every one of the Ten Commandments. Perhaps the place to start posting them is in the Oval Office. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that, Dale. It's very close to the dog's position, of course. We believe in the separation of religion from the state, and imposing religious practices on our public schools is just not on, because our public schools must be open to all children and offensive to none, which means that we can't have a state religion being imposed of any sort, or the establishment of any religion, not a particular religion, but any religion, on our public schools. But let's now go to our good news part of the hour. There's a very promising practical solution. We have very, very clever teachers in our public system. And up there in Sydney, there's a very interesting thing going on, and Andy's going to tell us all about it.
Thanks, Jean. A promising practical solution. Sydney's new schools-based therapy changes how teachers and parents deal with bullying. And this was published in The Guardian on Tuesday the 17th of June, written by Caitlin Cassidy. When children began at Ingleburn Public School in southwest Sydney with disruptive behaviour, parents often laid blame with the teachers and their educating style. Then the school opened a world-first behavioural clinic that brought families into the school grounds with dramatic results, according to the school's principal, Graham Green. He says that after 25 years on the job, seeing many programs with varying results, I've never seen such a calm, beautiful school operating. I believe that every area should have a hub, he says. Late in May, the federal government opened submissions for a review into bullying at Australian schools, noting its significant detrimental impacts on student mental health and well-being, including attendance, engagement, and learning outcomes. According to the Australian Council for Educational Research, ACER, Australia's disciplinary climate, how often disruptive behaviour means students miss out on learning opportunities, is significantly worse than the OECD average. Exposure to bullying is higher in Australian classrooms, which scored a negative 0.2, than all comparison countries, average 0.04, except Latvia. The review aims to develop a nationally consistent response to the issue, but some schools are already implementing highly effective behaviour programs, which they say, with funding, could be replicated at a larger scale. The Ingleburn Hub was developed by Eva Kimonis, a clinical psychologist and University of New South Wales professor, to help manage aggressive and disruptive student behaviour using an enhanced version of parent-child interaction therapy, PCIT. Students are referred via school-wide screening, teacher referral, or their transition to school program. Instead of a therapist working in a room with a child, they coach parents from behind a one-way mirror using an in-ear device. Over 21 weeks, parents receive intensive training to implement strategies to address disruptions. Teachers are also involved, embedding the strategies taught in the clinic into the classroom. The program's first trial worked with 69 prep and year one students in southwest Sydney, running across 17 schools with through two fixed on-site clinics. Kimonis says 91% of children who had shown disruptive, aggressive or destructive behaviour afterwards showed a return to typical behaviour levels. She recently received federal funding to scale up the program to more schools and regions over the next 2 years. Schools are telling us loud and clear, student behaviour is deteriorating and teachers are struggling to cope, Kimonis says. School PCIT offers a promising practical solution to a growing crisis. She says PCIT, which focused on children aged 2 to 7, works as an innovative early intervention. Green's Clinic, the first to open in mid-2019, was built using the school's own funding. Since then, students from 6 local schools and kindergartens in the areas have attended sessions on site. When a child comes in with issues, we want to work with the parent, Green says. Sometimes parents can think a student's behaviour might be the school's fault, but PCIT brings us all together. The biggest plus for me is the relationship with the community. A parent who might have been thinking, what's the school doing, is now working with us. Melissa Anderson, a psychologist and PCIT clinician at Ingleburn, says PCIT is one of the most effective programs for managing emotional and behavioural problems in young children. Developed in the 1970s by American professor Sheila Iberg, it did not emerge in Australia until the early 2000s. More than 20 clinics now operate nationwide. What Kimonis' approach has done differently and for the first time is deliver the program at school. With PCIT in a school setting, we can also involve the teachers and teach them some of these skills to use with the kids. It's a whole systems approach that gives kids much needed consistency, Anderson says. Katie Gapayard, the CEO of Australian charity The Fathering Project, says aggressive behaviour often starts before school, before children have the tools to regulate their emotions. The charity's research has found children whose fathers use consistent, warm parenting styles showed fewer emotional and behavioural problems. Supporting fathers from the early days of parenting, Gapayard says, creates ripple effects that reduce bullying and improve well-being across whole communities. Research suggests bullying arises from the complexity of children's relationships, including within the school, but families play an especially important role. So too do personal characteristics, including gender. While physical bullying is more common among boys, girls are more likely to experience cyberbullying. Cliche or not, the saying, "it takes a village to raise a child," rings true for educators. The President and Executive Director of the Australian Secondary Principals Association, ASPA, Andy Mizen, has been urging governments to better engage teachers and principals in policy design and for a broader community approach. Schools want to improve, Mizen says, and he wants to do the best job we can, but we can't do it alone. On Victoria's Mornington Peninsula, the village has come together to fund evidence-based programs in 9 local schools with low rankings on the Index of Community Socio-Educational Advantage. The cluster of schools has been supported by the Mornington Peninsula Foundation for around a decade to train teachers in evidence-based instruction and intervention, including phonics, years before it was rolled out in curriculums. This year, participating school Western Port Secondary College, WPSC, started using Dr. Tim McDonald's Classroom Mastery Program to inform classroom behaviour management. The intervention, funded by more than 200 individuals, families and trusts, focuses on scripted routines and predictability in the classroom to reduce students' cognitive load so they are more free to learn. For instance, the bell is a signal for the teacher, not students. They wait to be told to stand behind their chair, tidy their area and check there's no rubbish on the floor and put their chairs up before being dismissed row by row. If the routines aren't working and the class is misbehaving, they are taken outside, have the purpose of the teacher's script explained to them, and start again, sometimes multiple times. WPSC's principal, Chris Quinn, says during the program's short time frame, disruptions have drastically reduced. When the teacher owns their space and owns the entry, there's an increase in learning time, and that's what we've seen, he says. Students, especially senior students, initially saw the program as babyish, he says, but they've actually found that it's really benefited them because they just know exactly what's going to happen. For Quinn, behaviour management is fundamentally about politeness. Behaviour is something that's not innate, it's learned, he says. If we want young people to learn something, then we've got to model it. When exiting the classroom, we see students and teachers thanking each other at the door, rather than putting on a PowerPoint lesson on respect, which can often go in one ear and out the other. It's actually the lived experience of what it looks like. Back to you, Jean.
Well, isn't that wonderful? Because, as you know, our public schools are community schools, and our teachers and our parents and our children are what make them. And here there is this wonderful thing going on up there in Sydney, and you wouldn't have to be a prophet or the son of a prophet to work out who our great state school is this week. Back to Andy.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Ingleburn Public School. The year was 1887. In Ingleburn, pupils were attending their own school for the first time. In 1887, life in Sydney and the rest of the world was entirely different to what it is today. There were no motor vehicles then. Horse-drawn hansom cabs and buses and steam trams plied the streets of Sydney. Inner city suburbs were lit by gas and homes by gas or kerosene lamps. The sleepy hamlet of Ingleburn had just two stores, with a butcher and a blacksmith, and was the centre of a scattered settlement of small farms intersected by the railway line and numerous bullock team tracks. Almost every household grew its own vegetables and fruit. Today, Ingleburn has over 100 stores and four railway tracks. Until the year 1887, children of school age in Ingleburn had to walk or ride horses to Minto to attend school. Now, Ingleburn Public School and five other primary schools and preschools from southwest Sydney have partnered to establish the world's first school-based clinic to provide parent-child interaction therapy, PCIT, a gold standard program for managing emotional, oppositional and defiant behaviour in young children. Approximately 6% of Australian children have disruptive behaviour disorders. These problems persist throughout life and lead to later mental illness, family dysfunction and violence, academic failure and criminality, making them a serious public health concern. Parent-child interaction therapy, PCIT, is an evidence-based treatment. It has been scientifically studied in thousands of children and shown to be statistically and clinically effective in helping children with disruptive behaviour problems get back into the typical range of functioning. The unique school-based PCIT program sees parents receive real-time live coaching from a certified therapist who observes the parent and child playing from behind a one-way mirror. Using the latest technology, the therapist coaches the parent to apply evidence-based parental strategies by speaking into a microphone that connects to the wireless earpiece worn by the parent. The length of the program is tailored to the specific family needs, typically ranging from 14 to 21 sessions. Teachers of a student participating in the program will be invited to access informational and in-class support services tailored to the unique needs of both the student and teacher. These supports are designed to help teachers acquire and develop skills to better manage problematic behaviours within the classroom, which helps create a more positive teaching and learning environment for all. Children with untreated behaviour disorders may continue to be difficult and antisocial into their adult years. This can impact on their relationships, career prospects, and quality of life. Some children will develop more serious conduct and antisocial personality disorders, which are characterized by persistent, aggressive, criminal, and violent behaviors. By providing this early intervention within the schools and involving children, parents, and teachers, we will not only support at-risk children, improve their health, well-being, social, and academic outcomes, but also positively influence overall family functioning and create better teaching and learning environments. PCIT program is offered free of charge to identified at-risk students and their parents. The clinic operates from Ingleburn Public School and services the greater Campbelltown MacArthur area. Currently, the clinic is operating 2.5 days a week. And now some facts and figures from ACARA about Ingleburn Public School. The school currently has 429 students. 68% of the children speak another language besides English, and 7% are Indigenous. The ICSEA value of the school is only 988. And that means 8% of students have parents in the upper 25% of incomes, 24% of students in the next 25%, 31% of students have parents in the next quartile below 50%, and 37% in the lowest 25% of parental income. It costs the taxpayer $16,878 to educate a student at this school. The school receives $1.3 million from the federal government and $5.6 million from the state government, $48,000 from fees, and $149,000 from private fundraising. Only $1 million was received for capital grants in the last 3 years. All money well spent, and it'd be interesting to see how well this program continues to run in managing children's behaviour and whether we see it rolled out nationwide. Back to you, Jean.
Congratulations to Ingleburn Public School up there in New South Wales. They call them public schools. If you're interested in the dogs, then you can look us up on our website at www.adogs.info. From Dan and Andy and myself and Sol this week. And we hope to have Jeff back next week when he's feeling better. It's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.